Welcome back to A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce. We're on Chapter 5. It's Part 6 in our series. He drained his third cup of watery tea to the dregs and set to chewing the crusts of fried bread that were scattered near him, staring into the dark pool of the jar. The yellow dripping had been scooped out like a bog hole, and the pool under it brought back to his memory the dark, turf-coloured water of the bath in Clongowes. The box of pawn tickets at his elbow had just been rifled, and he took up idly one after another in his greasy fingers the blue and white dockets, scrawled and sanded and creased, and bearing the name of the pledger as Daly or McAvoy. One pair buskins, one D coat, three articles and white, one man's pants. Then he put them aside and gazed thoughtfully at the lid of the box, speckled with louse marks, and asked vaguely, "How much is the clock fast now?" His mother straightened the battered arm. His mother straightened the battered alarm clock that was lying on its side in the middle of the kitchen mantelpiece until its dial showed 11:45, and then laid it once more on its side. "An hour and 25 minutes," she said. "The right time now is 10:20. The dear knows you might try to be in time for your lectures." "Fill out the place for me to wash," said Stephen.
"Katy, fill out the place for Stephen to wash." "Broody, fill out the place for Stephen to wash."
"I can't, I'm going for blue. Fill it out you, Maggie."
When the enamelled basin had been fitted into the well of the sink and the old washing glove flung on the side of it, he allowed his mother to scrub his neck and root into the folds of his ears and into the interstices at the wings of his nose.
"Well, it's a poor case," she said, "when a university student is so dirty that his mother has to wash him."
"But it gives you pleasure," said Stephen calmly. An ear-splitting whistle was heard from upstairs, and his mother thrust a damp overall into his hands, saying, "Dry yourself and hurry out, for the love of goodness." A second shrill whistle, prolonged angrily, brought one of the girls to the foot of the staircase.
"Yes, father."
"Is your lady... is your lazy bitch of a brother gone out yet?"
"Yes, father."
"Sure?"
"Yes, father."
The girl came back, making signs to him to be quick and go out quietly by the back. Stephen laughed and said, "He has a curious idea of genders if he thinks a bitch is masculine."
"Ah, it's a scandalous shame for you, Stephen," said his mother, "and you live to rue the day you set your foot in that place. I know how it has changed you."
"Good morning, everybody," said Stephen, smiling and kissing the tips of his fingers in adieu. The lane behind the terrace was waterlogged, and as he went down it slowly, choosing his steps amid heaps of wet rubbish, he heard a mad nun screeching in a nun's madhouse beyond the wall.
"Jesus, oh Jesus, Jesus!"
He shook the sound out of his ears by an angry toss of his head and hurried on, stumbling through the mouldering offal, his heart already bitten by an ache of loathing and bitterness. His father's whistle, his mother's mutterings, the screech of an unseen maniac were to him now so many voices offending and threatening to humble the pride of his youth. He drove their echoes even out of his heart with an execration, but as he walked down the avenue and felt the grey morning light falling about him through the dripping leaves, trees, and smelt the strange wild smell of the wet leaves and bark, his soul was loosed of her miseries. The rain-laden trees of the avenue evoked in him, as always, memories of the girls and women in the plays of Gerhard Hauptmann, and the memory of their pale sorrows and the fragrance falling from the wet branches mingled in a mood of quiet joy. His morning walk across the city had begun, and he foreknew that as he passed the slablands of Fairview he would think of the cloistral, silver-veined prose of Newman, and as he walked along the North Strand Road, glancing idly at the windows of the provision shops, he would recall the dark humour of Guido Cavalcanti and smile, that as he went by Baird's stone-cutting works in Talbot Place, the spirit of Ibsen would blow through him like a keen wind, a spirit of wayward, boyish beauty, and that, passing a grimy marin dealer's shop beyond the Liffey, he would repeat the song by Ben Jonson, which begins, "I was not wearier where I lay." His mind, when wearied of its search for the essence of beauty amid the spectral works of Aristotle or Aquinas, turned often for its pleasure to the dainty songs of the Elizabethans. His mind, in the vesture of a doubting monk, stood often in shadow under the windows of that age to hear the grave and mocking music of the lutenists or the frank laughter of waistcoaters, until a laugh too low, a phrase tarnished by time of chambering and false humour, stung his monkish pride and drove him on from his lurking place. The lore which he was believed to pass his days brooding upon, so that it had wrapped him from the companionships of youth, was only a garner of slender sentences from Aristotle's Poetics and Psychology, and a synopsis philosophique scholastic ad mentem divi tomisi. His thinking was a dusk of doubt and self-mistrust, lit up at moments by the lightnings of intuition, but lightnings of so clear a splendour that in those moments the world perished about his feet as if it had been fire-consumed. And thereafter his tongue grew heavy, and he met the eyes of others with unanswering eyes, for he felt that the spirit of beauty had folded him round like a mantle, and that in reverie at least he had been acquainted with nobility. But when this brief pride of silence upheld him no longer, he was glad to find himself still in the midst of common lives, passing on his way amid the squalor and noise and sloth of the city fearlessly and with a light heart. Near the hoardings of the canal, he met the consumptive man with the doll's face and the brimless hat coming towards him down the slope of the bridge with little steps, tightly buttoned into his chocolate overcoat, and holding his furled umbrella a span or two from him like a divining rod. "It must be 11," he thought, and peered into a dairy to see the time. The clock in the dairy told him that it was 5 minutes to 5, but as he turned away he heard a clock somewhere near him, but unseen, beaten 11 strokes in swift precision. He laughed as he heard it, for it made him think of McCann, and he saw him a squat figure in a shooting jacket and breeches, and with a fair goatee, standing in the wind at Hopkins Corner, and heard him say, "Dedalus, you're an antisocial being, wrapped up in yourself. I'm not, I'm a democrat, and I'll work and act for social liberty and equality among all classes and sexes in the United States of the Europe of the future." 11. Then he was late for that lecture, too. What day of the week was it? He stopped at a newsagent's to read the headline of a placard. "Thursday, 10 to 11 English, 11 to 5 French, 12 to 1 physics." He fancied to himself the English lecture and felt, even at that distance, restless and helpless. He saw the heads of his classmates meekly bent as they wrote in their notebooks the points they were bidden to note, nominal definitions, essential definitions and examples, or dates of birth or death, chief works, a favourable and unfavourable criticism side by side. His own head was unbent, for his thoughts wandered abroad, and whether he looked around a little class of students or out of the window across the desolate gardens of the green, an odour assailed him of cheerless cellar damp and decay. Another head than his, right before him in the first benches, was poised squarely above its bending fellows, like the head of a priest appealing about humility to the tabernacle for the humble worshippers about him. Why was it that when he thought of Cranley he could never raise before his mind the entire image of his body, but only the image of the head and face? Even now, against the grey curtain of the morning, he saw it before him like the phantom of a dream, the face of a severed head or death mask, crowned on the brows by its stiff black upright hair as by an iron crown. It was a priest-like face, priest-like in its pallor, in the wide-winged nose, in the shadowings below the eyes and along the jaws, priest-like in the lips that were long and bloodless and faintly smiling. And Stephen, remembering swiftly how he had told Cranley of all the tumults and unrest and longings in his soul, day after day and night by night, only to be answered by his friend's listening silence, would have told himself that it was the face of a guilty priest who heard confessions of those whom he had not the power to absolve, but that he felt again in memory the gaze of its dark womanish eyes. Through this image he had a glimpse of a strange dark cavern of speculation, but at once turned away from it, feeling that it was not yet the hour to enter it. But the nightshade of his friend's listlessness seemed to be diffusing in the air around him a tenuous and deadly exhalation, and he found himself glancing from one casual word to another on his right or his left, in stolid wonder that they had been so silently emptied of instantaneous sense until every mean shop legend bound his mind like the words of a spell, and his soul shriveled up, sighing with age, as he walked on in a lane among heaps of dead language. His own consciousness of language was ebbing from his brain and trickling into the very words themselves, which set to band and disband themselves in wayward rhythms. The ivy winds upon the wall, and winds and twines upon the wall. The ivy winds upon the wall. The yellow ivy on the wall. Ivy, ivy up the wall. Did anyone ever hear such drivel? Lord Almighty, who ever heard of ivy whining on a wall? Yellow ivy, that was all right. Yellow ivory also. And what about ivory ivy? The word now shone in his brain, clearer and brighter than any ivory sound from the mottled tusks of elephants. Ivory. Ivoire, Ivorio, Ibor. One of the first examples that he had learnt in Latin had run India mitit Ibor, and he recalled the shrewd northern face of the rector who had taught him to construe the Metamorphoses of Ovid in a courtly English made whimsical by the mention of porkers and potsherds and chines of bacon. He had learned what little he knew of the laws of Latin verse from a ragged book written by a Portuguese priest.
Contra hit orator, variant in carmine vates. The crises and victories and secessions in Roman history were handed on to him in the trite words in tanto discramin, and he had tried to peer into the social life of the city of cities through the words implir olam denorium,
which the rector had rendered sonorously, as the filling of a pot with denaries. The pages of his time-worn Horace never felt cold to the touch, even when his own fingers were cold. They were human pages, and 50 years before they had been turned by the human fingers of John Duncan in Verarity, and by his brother William Malcolm in Verarity. Yes, those were noble names on the dusky flyleaf, and even for so poor a Latinist as he, the dusky verses were as fragrant as though they had lain all those years in myrtle and lavender and vervain. But yet it wounded him to think that he would never be but a shy guest at the feast of the world's culture, and that the monkish learning, in terms of what he was striving to forge out, in terms of which he was striving to forge out an aesthetic philosophy, was held no higher by the age he lived in than the subtle and curious jargons of heraldry and falconry. The grey block of Trinity on his left set heavily in the city's ignorance, like a great dull stone set in a cumbrous ring, pulled his mind downward, and while he was striving this way and that to free his feet from the fetters of the reformed conscience, he came upon the droll statue of the national poet of Ireland. He looked at it without anger, for though sloth of the body and of the soul crept over it like unseen vermin, over the shuffling feet and up the folds of the cloak and around the servile head, it seemed humbly conscious of its dignity. Indignity. It was a firbolg in the borrowed cloak of a Milesian, and he thought of his friend Davin, the peasant student. It was a jesting name between them, but the young peasant bore with it lightly, saying, "Go on, Stevie, I have a hard head, you tell me. Call me what you will." The homely version of this Christian name on the lips of his friend had touched Stephen pleasantly when first heard, for he was as formal in speech with others as they were with him. Often as he sat in Davin's rooms in Grantham Street, wondering at his friend's well-made boots that flanked the wall pair by pair, and repeating for his friend's simple ear the verses and cadences of others, which were the veils of his own longing and dejection, the rude fear-bog mind of his listener had drawn his mind towards it and flung it back again, drawing it by a quiet inbred courtesy of attention, or by a quaint turn of old English speech, or by the force of its delight in rude bodily skill, for Davin had sat at the feet of Michael Cusack de Gael, repelling swiftly and suddenly by a grossness of intelligence, or by a bluntness of feeling, or by a dull stare of terror in the eyes, the terror of soul of a starving Irish village in which the curfew was still a nightly fear. Side by side with his memory of the deeds of prowess of his uncle, Matt Davin the athlete, the young peasant worshipped the sorrowful legend of Ireland. The gossip of his fellow students, which strove to render the flat life of the college significant at any cost, loved to think of him as a young Fenian. His nurse had taught him Irish and shaped his rude imagination by the broken lights of Irish myth. He stood towards this myth upon which no individual mind had ever drawn out a line of beauty, and to its unwieldy tales that divided themselves as they moved down the cycles, in the same attitude as towards the Roman Catholic religion, the attitude of a dull-witted loyal serf. Whatsoever of thought or of feeling came to him from England or by way of English culture, his mind stood armed against in obedience to a password. And of the world that lay beyond England he knew only the foreign legion of France in which he spoke of serving. Coupling this ambition with the young man's humour, Stephen had often called him one of the tame geese, and there was even a point of irritation in the name pointed against that very reluctance of speech and deed in his friend, which seemed so often to stand between Stephen's mind, eager of speculation, and the hidden ways of Irish life. One night the young peasant, his spirit stung by the violent or luxurious language in which Stephen escaped from the cold silence of intellectual revolt, had called up before Stephen's mind a strange vision. The two were walking slowly towards Davin's room through the dark, narrow streets of the poorer Jews. "A thing happened to myself, Stevie, last autumn, coming on winter, and I never told it to a living soul, and you were the first person now I ever told it to. I disremember if it was October or November. It was October, because it was before I came over here to join the matriculation class." Stephen had turned his smiling eyes towards his friend's face, flattered by his confidence and won over to sympathy by the speaker's simple accent. "I was away all that day from my own place over in Buttervent, but I don't know if you know where that is, at a hurling match between the Croke's own boys and the Fearless Thurlers. And by God, Stevie, that was the hard fight. My first cousin, Fonzie Davin, was stripped to his buff that day, minding cool for the Limericks, but he was up with the forwards half the time and shouting like mad. I never will forget that day. One of the Croaks made a woeful swipe at him one time with his come on, and I declare to God he was within an aim's ace of getting it at the side of the temple. Oh, honest to God, if the crook of it had caught him that time, he was done for." "I'm glad he escaped," Stephen had said with a laugh, "but surely that's not the strange thing that happened to you." "Well, I suppose that doesn't interest you, but leastways there was such noise after the match that I missed the train home, and I couldn't get any kind of a yoke to give me a lift, for, as luck would have it, there was a mass meeting that same day over in Castletown Roach, and all the cars in the country were there. So there was nothing for it only to stay the night or to foot it out. Well, I started to walk, and on I went, and it was coming on night when I got into the Ballyhoura Hills. That's better than 10 miles from Kilmallock, and there's a long, lonely road after that. You wouldn't see the sign of a Christian house along the road or hear a sound. It was pitch dark almost. Once or twice I stopped by the way under a brush to redden my pipe, and only for the dew was thick I'd have stretched out there and slept. At last, after a bend in the road, I spied a little cottage with a light in the window. I went up and knocked at the door. A voice asked who was there, and I answered I was over at the match in Buttervent, and was walking back, and that I'd be thankful for a glass of water. After a while, a young woman opened the door and brought me out a big mug of milk. She was half undressed, as if she was going to bed when I knocked, and she had her hair hanging, and I thought by her figure and by something in the look of her eyes that she must be carrying a child. She kept me in talk a long while at the door, and I thought it strange because her breast and her shoulders were bare. She asked me was I tired, and would I like to stop the night there. She said she was all alone in the house, and that her husband had gone off that morning to Queenstown with his sister to see her off. And all the time she was talking, Stevie, she had her eyes fixed on my face, and she stood so close to me I could hear her breathing. When I handed her back the mug at last, she took my hand to draw me in over the threshold and said, "Come in and stay the night here. You've no call to be frightened. There's no one in it but ourselves." I didn't go in, Stevie. I thanked her and went on my way again, all in a fever. At the first bend of the road I looked back, and she was standing at the door. The last words of Davin's story sang in his memory, and the figure of the woman in the story stood forth, reflected in other figures of the peasant women whom he had seen standing in the doorways at Clane as the college cars drove by, as a type of her race and his own. A bat-like soul waking to the consciousness of itself in darkness and secrecy and loneliness, and through the eyes and voice and gesture of a woman without guile, calling the stranger to her bed. A hand was laid on his arm, and a young voice cried, "Ah, gentlemen, your own girl, sir. The first handsel today, gentlemen. Buy that lovely bunch, will you, gentlemen?" The blue flowers which she lifted towards him, and her young blue eyes, seemed to him at that instant images of guilelessness. And he halted till the image had vanished, and he saw only her ragged dress and damp coarse hair and hoydenish face. "Do, gentlemen, don't forget your own girl, sir." "I have no money," said Stephen. "Buy them lovely ones, will you, sir? Only a penny." "Did you hear what I said?" said Stephen, bending towards her. "I told you I had no money. I'll tell you again now." "Well, sure, you will some day, sir, please God," the girl answered after an instant. "Possibly," said Stephen, "but I don't think it likely." He left her quickly, fearing that her intimacy might turn to jibing, and wishing to be out of the way before she offered her ware to another, a tourist from England or a student from Trinity. Grafton Street, along which he walked, prolonged that moment of discouraged poverty. In the roadway at the head of the street a slab was set to the memory of Wolfe Tone, and he remembered having been present with his father at its laying. He remembered with bitterness the scene of tawdry tribute. There were four French delegates in a brake, and one, a plump smiling young man, had wedged on a stick a card on which were printed the words, "Vive l'Irlande!" But the trees in Stephen's Green were fragrant of rain, and the rain-sodden earth gave forth its mortal odour, a faint incense rising upward through the mould from many hearts. The soul of the gallant venal city which his elders had told him of had shrunk with time to a faint mortal odour rising from the earth, and he knew that in a moment when he entered the sombre college he would be conscious of a corruption other than that of Buck Egan and Byrne Chapel Whaley. It was too late to go upstairs to the French class. He crossed the hall and took the corridor to the left which led to the physics theatre. The corridor was dark and silent, but not unwatchful. Why did he feel that it was not unwatchful? Was it because he had heard that in Buck Whaley's time there was a secret staircase there? Or was the Jesuit house extra territorial, and was he walking among aliens? The Ireland of Tone and of Parnell seemed to have receded in space. He opened the door of the theatre and halted in the chilly grey light that struggled through the dusty windows. A figure was crouching before the large grate, and by its leanness and greyness he knew that it was the Dean of Studies lighting the fire. Stephen closed the door quietly and approached the fireplace. "Good morning, sir. Can I help you?" The priest looked up quickly and said, "One moment now, Mr. Dedalus, and you will see. There is an art in lighting a fire. We have the liberal arts and we have the useful arts. This is one of the useful arts." "I will try to learn it," said Stephen. "Not too much coal," said the Dean, working briskly at his task. "That is one of the secrets." He produced four candle butts from the side pockets of his soutane and placed them deftly, the coals, among the coals and twisted papers. Stephen watched him in silence. Kneeling thus on the flagstone to kindle the fire, and busied with the disposition of his wisps of paper and candle-butts, he seemed more than ever a humble server, making ready the place of sacrifice in an empty temple, a Levite of the Lord. Like a Levite's robe of plain linen, the faded, worn soutane, draped the kneeling figure of one whom the canonicals or the bell-boarded ephod would irk and trouble. His very body had waxed old in lowly service of the Lord, in tending the fire upon the altar, in bearing tidings secretly, in waiting upon worldlings, in striking swiftly when bidden, and yet had remained ungraced by aught of saintly or of prelatic beauty. Nay, his very soul had waxed old in that service, without growing towards light and beauty, or spreading abroad a sweet odour of her sanctity, a mortified will no more responsive to the thrill of its obedience than was to the thrill of love or combat his ageing body, spare and sinewy, greyed with a silver pointed down. The dean rested back on his hunkers and watched the sticks catch. Stephen, to fill the silence, said, "I am sure I could not light a fire." "You are an artist, are you not, Mr. Dedalus?" said the dean, glancing up and blinking his pale eyes. "The object of the artist is the creation of the beautiful. What the beautiful is another question." He rubbed his hands slowly and dryly over the difficulty. "Can you solve that question now?" he asked. "Aquinas," answered Stephen, "says, pulchra sunt quo visa placent." Apologies for the noise, I dropped you. "This fire before us," said the dean, "will be pleasing to the eye. Will it therefore be beautiful?" "In so far as it is apprehended by the sight, which I suppose means here aesthetic intellection, it will be beautiful. But Aquinas also says, bonum est in quod tendit appetitus. In so far as it satisfies the animal craving for warmth, fire is good. In hell, however, it is an evil." "Quite so," said the dean. "You have certainly hit the nail on the head." He rose nimbly and went towards the door, set it ajar, and said, "A draught is said to be a help in these matters." As he came back to the hearth, limping slightly but with a brisk step, Stephen saw the silent soul of a Jesuit look out at him from the pale, loveless eyes. Like Ignatius, he was lame, but in his eyes burned no spark of Ignatius's enthusiasm. Even the legendary craft of the company, a craft subtler and more secret than its fabled books of secret subtle wisdom, had not fired his soul with the energy of apostleship. It seemed as if he used the shifts and lore and cunning of the world, as bidden to do, for the greater glory of God, without joy in their handling or hatred of that in them which was evil, but turning them with a firm gesture of obedience back upon themselves. And for all this silent service, it seemed as if he loved not at all the master, and little, if at all, the ends he served. Similiter atque senis speculus he was, as the founder would have had him. Like a staff in an old man's hand, to be left in a corner, to be leaned on in the road at nightfall, or in stress of weather, to lie with a lady's nosegay on a garden seat, to be raised in menace. The dean returned to the hearth and began to stroke his chin. "When may we expect to have something from you on the aesthetic question?" he asked. "From me?" said Stephen in astonishment. "I stumble on an idea once a fortnight if I am lucky." "These questions are very profound, Mr. Dedalus," said the dean. "It is like looking from the cliffs of Moher into the depths. Many go down, down into the depths and never come up. Only the trained diver can go down into those depths and explore them and come to the surface again." "If you mean speculation, sir," said Stephen, "I also am sure that there is no such thing as free thinking, inasmuch as all thinking must be bound by its own laws." "Ha! For my purpose, I can work on at present by the light of one or two ideas of Aristotle and Aquinas." "I see, I quite see your point. I need them only for my own use and guidance until I have done something for myself by their light. If the lamp smokes or smells, I shall try to trim it. If it does not give light enough, I shall sell it and buy another." "'Epictetus also had a lamp,' said the dean, "'which was sold for a fancy price after his death. "'It was the lamp he wrote his philosophical dissertations by. "'You know Epictetus?'
"'An old gentleman,' said Stephen coarsely, "'who said that the soul is very like a bucketful of water.'
"'He tells us in his homely way,' the dean went on, "'that he put an iron lamp before a statue of one of the gods, "'and that a thief stole the lamp. "'What did the philosopher do? "'He reflected that it was in the character of a thief to steal, "'and determined to buy an earthen lamp next day instead of the iron lamp.'
"'A smell of molten tallow came up from the dean's candle-butts "'and fused itself in Stephen's consciousness with the jingle of the words.' Bucket and lamp into bucket. The priest's voice, too, had a hard, jingling tone. Stephen's mind halted by instinct, checked by the strange tone and the imagery, and by the priest's face, which seemed like an unlit lamp, or a reflector hung in a false focus. What lay behind it or within it? A dull torpor of the soul, or the dullness of the thundercloud, charged with intellection and capable of gloom of God?
"'I meant a different king of lamps, sir,' said Stephen.
"'Undoubtedly,' said the dean.
"'One difficulty,' said Stephen, "'in aesthetic discussion, "'is to know whether words are being used "'according to the literary tradition, "'or according to the tradition of the marketplace. "'I remember a sentence in Newman's "'in which he says of the Blessed Virgin "'that she was detained in the full company of the saints. "'The use of the word in the marketplace is quite different. "'I hope I am not detaining you.'
"'Not in the least.' "'said the dean politely.
"'No, no,' said Stephen, smiling. "'I mean—'
"'Yes, yes, I see,' said the dean quickly. "'I quite catch your point. Detain.'
"'He thrust forward his under jaw "'and uttered a dry, short cough. "'To return to the lamp,' he said. "'The feeding of it is also a nice problem. "'You must choose the pure oil, "'and you must be careful when you pour it in, "'not to overflow it, "'not to pour in more than the funnel can hold.'
"'What funnel?' asked Stephen.
"'The funnel through which you pour the oil into your lamp.'
"'That,' said Stephen, "'is that called a funnel? "'Is it not a tundish?'
"'What is a tundish?'
"'That, the funnel.'
"'Is that called a tundish in Ireland?' asked the dean. "'I never heard the word in my life.'
"'It is called a tundish in Lower Drumcondra,' said Stephen, laughing, "'where they speak the best English.'
"'A tundish,' said the dean reflectively. "'That is a most interesting word. "'I must look that word up. "'Upon my word, I must—'
"'His courtesy of manner rang a little false, "'and Stephen looked at the English convert "'with the same eyes as the elder brother in the parable "'may have turned on the prodigal. "'A humble follower in the wake of clamorous conversions, "'a poor Englishman in Ireland, "'he seemed to have entered on the stage of Jesuit history "'when that strange play of intrigue and suffering "'and envy and struggle and indignity "'had been all but given through. "'A late corner, a tardy spirit. "'From what had he set out? "'Perhaps he had been born and bred among serious dissenters, "'seeing salvation in Jesus only "'and abhorring the vain pomps of the establishment.' Had he felt the need of an implicit fate amid the welter of sectarianism and the jargon of its turbulent schisms? Six principal men, peculiar people, seed and snake Baptists, supralapsarian dogmatists. Had he found the true church all of a sudden, in winding up to the end like a reel of cotton, some fine spun line of reasoning upon insufflation or the imposition of hands or the procession of the Holy Ghost? Or had Lord Christ touched him and bidden him follow, like that disciple who had sat at the receipt of custom, as he sat at by the door of some zinc-roofed chapel, yawning and telling over his church pence?
The dean repeated the word yet again. Tundish! Well, now, that is interesting. The question you asked me a moment ago seems to me more interesting. "'What is that beauty which the artist struggles to express from lumps of earth?' said Stephen coldly. The little word seemed to have turned a rapier point of his sensitiveness against this courteous and vigilant foe. He felt with a smart of dejection that the man to whom he was speaking was a countryman of Ben Jonson. He thought, The language in which we are speaking is his before it is mine. How different are the words home, Christ, ale, master, on his lips and on mine. I cannot speak or write these words without unrest of spirit. His language, so familiar and so foreign, will always be for me an acquired speech. I have not made or accepted its words. My voice holds them at bay. My soul frets in the shadow of his language. And to distinguish between the beautiful and the sublime, the dean added, to distinguish between moral beauty and material beauty, and to inquire what kind of beauty is proper to each of the various arts, these are some interesting points we might take up. Stephen, disheartened suddenly by the dean's firm, dry tone, was silent. The dean also was silent, and through the silence a distant noise of many boots and confused voices came up the staircase. "In pursuing these speculations," said the dean conclusively, "there is, however, the danger of perishing of inaction, of inanition. First you must take your degree. Set that before you as your first aim. Then, little by little, you will see your way. I mean in every sense, your way in life and in thinking. It may be uphill peddling at first. Take Mr. Moonan. He was a long time before he got to the top, but he got there." "I may not have his talent," said Stephen quietly. "You never know," said the dean brightly. "We never can say what is in us. I most certainly should not be despondent. Per aspera ad astra." He left the hearth quickly and went towards the landing to oversee the arrival of the first arts class. Leaning against the fireplace, Stephen heard him greet briskly and impartially every student of the class, and could almost see the frank smiles of the coarser students. A desolating pity began to fall like a dew upon his easily embittered heart for this faithful serving-man of the knightly Loyola, for this half-brother of the clergy, more venal than they in speech, more steadfast of soul than they, one whom he would never call his ghostly father. And he thought how this man and his companions had earned the name of worldlings at the hands not of the unworldly, but unworldly only, but of the worldly also, for having pleaded during all their history at the bar of God's justice for the souls of the lax and the lukewarm and the prudent. The entry of the professor was signalled by a few rounds of Kentish fire from the heavy boots of those students who sat on the highest tier of the gloomy theatre, under the grey cobwebbed windows. The calling of the roll began, and the responses to the names were given out in all tones, until the name of Peter Byrne was reached. "Here!" A deep bass tone in response came from the upper tier, followed by coughs of protest along the other benches. The professor paused in his reading and called the next name. "Cranley!" No answer. "Mr. Cranley!" A smile flew across Stephen's face as he thought of his friend's studies. "Try Leopardstown," said a voice from the bench behind. Stephen glanced up quickly, but Moynihan's snoutish face, outlined in the grey light, was impassive. A formula was given out. Amid the rustling of the notebooks, Stephen turned back again and said, "Give me some paper, for God's sake." "Are you as bad as that?" asked Moynihan with a broad grin. He tore a sheet from his scribbler and passed it down, whispering, "In case of necessity, any layman or woman can do it." The formula, which he wrote obediently on the sheet of paper, the coiling and uncoiling calculations of the professor, the spectre-like symbols of force and velocity, fascinated and jaded Stephen's mind. He had heard some say that the old professor was an atheist Freemason. Oh, the grey, dull day! It seemed a limbo of painless, patient consciousness through which souls of mathematicians might wander, projecting long, slender fabrics from plane to plane of ever rarer and paler twilight, radiating swift eddies to the last verges of a universe ever vaster, farther, and more impalpable. "So we must distinguish between elliptical and ellipsoidal. Perhaps some of you gentlemen may be familiar with the works of Mr. W. S. Gilbert. In one of his songs he speaks of the billiard sharp, who is condemned to play on a cloth untrue, with a twisted cue, and elliptical billiard balls. He means a ball having the form of the ellipsoid of the principal axis of which I spoke a moment ago. Moynihan leaned down towards Stephen's ear and murmured, "What price ellipsoidal balls? Chase me, ladies, I'm in the cavalry." His fellow student's rude humour ran like a gust through the cloister of Stephen's mind, shaking into gay life limp priestly vestments that hung upon the walls, setting them to sway and caper in a sabbath of misrule. The forms of the community emerged from the gust-blown vestments. The Dean of Studies, the portly, florid bursar with his cap of grey hair, the President, the little priest with feathery hair who wrote devout verses, the squat peasant form of the Professor of Economics, the tall form of the young Professor of Mental Science, discussing on the landing a case of conscience with his class, like a giraffe cropping his leafage among a herd of antelopes. The grave, troubled prefect of the sodality, the plump, round-headed professor of Italian with his rogue's eyes. They came ambling and stumbling, tumbling and capering, kilting their gowns for leapfrog, holding one another, shaken with deep false laughter, smacking one another behind and laughing at their rude malice, calling to one another by familiar nicknames, protesting with sudden dignity at some rough usage, whispering two and two behind their hands. The professor had gone to the glass cases on the side wall, from a shelf of which he took down a set of coils, blew away the dust from many points, and bearing it carefully to the table, held a finger on it while he proceeded with his lecture. He explained that the wires in modern coils were of a compound called platinoid, lately discovered by F. W. Martino. He spoke clearly the initials and the surname of the discoverer. Moynihan whispered from behind, "Good old Freshwater Martin." "Ask him," Stephen whispered back with weary humour, "if he wants a subject for electrocution. He can have me." Moynihan, seeing the professor bend over the coils, rose in his bench and, clacking noiselessly the fingers of his right hand, began to call with the voice of a slobbering urchin, "Please, teacher, please, teacher, this boy is after saying a bad word, teacher." "Platinoid," the professor said solemnly, "is preferred to German silver because it has a lower coefficient of resistance variation by changes of temperature. The platinoid wire is insulated, and the covering of silk that insulates it is wound on the ebonite bobbins just where my finger is. If it were wound single, an extra current would be induced in the coils. The bobbins are saturated in hot paraffin wax." A sharp Ulster voice said from the bench below Stephen, "Are we likely to be asked questions on applied science?" The professor began to juggle gravely with the terms pure science and applied science. A heavy-built student, wearing gold spectacles, stared with some wonder at the questioner. Moynihan murmured from behind in his natural voice, "Is it McAllister a devil for his pound of flesh?" Stephen looked down coldly on the oblong skull beneath him, overgrown with tangled, twine-coloured hair. The voice, the accent, the mind of the questioner offended him, and he allowed the offence to carry him towards wilful unkindness, bidding his mind think that the student's father would have done better had he sent his son to Belfast to study, and have saved something on the train fare by so doing. The oblong skull beneath him did not turn to meet this shaft of thought, and yet the shaft came back to its bowstring, for he saw in a moment the student's wave-pale face. "That thought is not mine," he said to himself quickly. "It came from the comic Irishman on the bench behind. Patience. Can you say with certitude by whom the soul of your race was bartered and its elect betrayed, by the questioner or by the mocker? Patience. Remember Epictetus. It is probably in his character to ask such a question at such a moment in such a tone, and to pronounce the word science in a monosyllable. Monosyllable." The droning voice of the professor continued to wind itself slowly round and round the coils it spoke of, doubling, trebling, quadrupling its somnolent energy as the coil multiplied its ohms of resistance. Moynihan's voice called from behind an echo to a distant bell. "Closing time, gents." The entrance hall was crowded and loud with talk. On a table near the door were two photographs in frames, and between them a long roll of paper bearing an irregular tale of signatures. McCann went briskly to and fro among the students, talking rapidly, answering rebuffs, and leading one after another to the table. In the inner hall, the Dean of Studies stood talking to a young professor, stroking his chin gravely and nodding his head. Stephen, checked by the crowd at the door, halted irresolutely. From under the wide falling leaf of a soft hat, Cranley's dark eyes were watching him. "Have you signed?" Stephen asked. Cranley closed his long, thin-lipped mouth, communed with himself an instant, and answered, "Ego habeo." "What is it for?" "Quod?" "What is it for?" Cranley turned his pale face to Stephen and said blandly and bitterly, "Par pax universalis." Stephen pointed to the Tsar's photograph and said, "He has the face of a besotted Christ." The scorn and anger in his voice brought Cranley's eyes back from a calm survey of the walls of the hall. "Are you annoyed?" he asked. "No," answered Stephen. "Are you in bad humour?" "No." "Credoed vos sanguinarius mendax etis," said Cranley. "Quia facies vostra monstrat, ut vos in damno malo humor estis." Moynihan, on his way to the table, said in Stephen's ear, "McCann's in tip-top form, ready to shed the last drop. Brand new world, no stimulants and votes for the bitches." Stephen smiled at the manner of this confidence, and, when Moynihan had passed, turned again to meet Cranley's eyes. "Perhaps you can tell me," he said, "why he pours his soul so freely into my ear. Can you?" A dull scowl appeared on Cranley's forehead. He stared at the table where Moynihan had bent to write his name on the roll, and then said flatly, "A sugar?" "Quis est in malo humor?" said Stephen. "Ego aut vos?" Cranley did not take up the taunt. He brooded sourly on his judgment, and repeated with the same flat force, "A flaming bloody sugar, that's what he is." It was his epitaph for all dead friendships, and Stephen wondered whether it would ever be spoken in the same tone over his memory. The heavy, lumpish phrase sank slowly out of hearing, like a stone through a quagmire. Stephen saw it sink, as he had seen many another, feeling its heaviness depress his heart. Cranley's speech, unlike that of Davin, had neither rare phrases of Elizabethan English nor quaintly turned versions of Irish idioms. Its drawl was an echo of the keys of Dublin given back by a bleak, decaying seaport. Its energy, an echo of the sacred eloquence of Dublin given back flatly by a Wicklow pulpit. The heavy scowl faded from Cranley's face as McCann marched briskly towards them from the other side of the hall.
"Here you are," said McCann cheerily.
"Here I am," said Stephen.
"Late as usual. Can you not combine the progressive tendency with a respect for punctuality?"
"That question is out of order," said Stephen. "Next business."
His smiling eyes were fixed on a silver-wrapped tablet of milk chocolate which peeped out of the propagandist's breast pocket. A little ring of listeners closed round to hear the war of wits. A lean student with olive skin and lank black hair thrust his face between the two, glancing from one to the other at each phrase, and seeming to try to catch each flying phrase in his open, moist mouth. Cranley took a small grey handbill from his pocket and began to examine it closely, turning it over and over.
"Next business," said McCann. "Hum!"
He gave a loud cough of laughter, smiled broadly, and tugged twice at the straw-coloured goatee which hung from his blunt chin.
"The next business is to sign the testimonial."
"Will you pay me anything if I sign?" asked Stephen.
"I thought you were an idealist," said McCann.
The gypsy-like student looked about him and addressed the onlookers in an indistinct, bleating voice.
"By hell, that's a queer notion. I consider that notion to be a mercenary notion."
His voice faded into silence. No heed was paid to his words. He turned his olive face, equine in expression, towards Stephen, inviting him to speak again. McCann began to speak with fluent energy of the Tsar's rescript, of stead, of general disarmament, arbitration in cases of international disputes, of the signs of the times, of the new humanity and the new gospel of life, which would make it the business of the community to secure as cheaply as possible the greatest possible happiness of the greatest possible number. The gypsy student responded to the close of the period by crying, "Three cheers for universal brotherhood." "Go on, Temple," said a stout ruddy student near him. "I'll stand you a pint after." "I'm a believer in universal brotherhood," said Temple, glancing about him out of his dark oval eyes. "Marx is only a bloody cod." Cranley gripped his arm tightly to check his tongue, smiling uneasily, and repeated, "Easy, easy, easy." Temple struggled to free his arm, but continued, his mouth flecked by a thin foam. "Socialism was founded by an Irishman, and the first man in Europe who preached the freedom of thought was Collins. 200 years ago, he denounced priestcraft, the philosopher of Middlesex. Three cheers for John Anthony Collins." A thin voice from the verge of the ring replied, "Pip, pip." Moynihan murmured beside Stephen's ear, "And what about little John Anthony's? And what about John Anthony's poor little sister? Lottie Collins lost her drawers. Won't you kindly lend her yours?" Stephen laughed, and Moynihan, pleased with the result, murmured again, We've 5 bob each way and John Anthony Collins." "I am waiting for your answer," said McCann briefly. "The affair doesn't interest me in the least," said Stephen wearily. "You know that well. Why do you make a scene about it?" "Good," said McCann, smacking his lips. "You are a reactionary, then." "Do you think you impress me," Stephen asked, "with your flourish, when you flourish your wooden sword?" "Metaphors," said McCann bluntly. "Come to facts." Stephen blushed and turned aside. McCann stood his ground and said with hostile humour, "Minor poets, I suppose, are above such trivial questions as the question of universal peace." Cranley raised his head and held the handball between the two students by way of peace offering, saying, "Pax super totum, sanguinarium globum." Stephen, moving away the bystanders, jerked his shoulder angrily in the direction of the Tsar's image, saying, "Keep your icon. If we must have a Jesus, let us have a legitimate Jesus." "By hell, that's a good one," said the gypsy student to those about him. "That's a fine expression. I like that expression immensely." He gulped down the spittle in his throat as if he were gulping down the phrase, and, fumbling at the peak of his tweed cap, turned to Stephen, saying, "Excuse me, sir, what do you mean by that expression you uttered just now?" Feeling himself jostled by the students near him, he said to them, "I am curious to know what he meant by that expression." He turned again to Stephen and said in a whisper, "Do you believe in Jesus?" "I believe in man. Of course, I don't know if you believe in man. I admire you, sir. I admire the man, mind of a man, independent of all religions. Is that your opinion about the mind of Jesus?" "Go on, Temple," said the stout ruddy student, returning, as was his wont, to his first idea. "That pint is waiting for you." "He thinks I'm an imbecile," Temple explained to Stephen, "because I'm a believer in the power of mind." Cranley linked his arms into those of Stephen and his admirer and said, "No sad manum balum joc abimus." Stephen, in the act of being led away, caught sight of McCann's flush, blunt-featured face. "My signature is of no account," he said politely. "You are right to go your way. Leave me to go mine." "Dedalus," said McCann crisply, "I believe you're a good fellow, but you have yet to learn the dignity of altruism and the responsibility of the human individual." A voice said, "Intellectual crankery is better out of this movement than in it." "Let me try that again. Intellectual crankery is better out of this moment than in it." Stephen, recognising the harsh tone of McAllister's voice, did not turn in the direction of the voice. Cranley pushed solemnly through the throng of students, linking Stephen and Temple like a celebrant attended by his ministers on his way to the altar. Temple bent eagerly across Cranley's breast and said, "Did you hear McAllister what he said? That youth is jealous of you. Did you see that? I bet Cranley didn't see that. By hell, I saw that at once." As they crossed the inner hall, the Dean of Studies was in the act of escaping from the student with whom he had been conversing. He stood at the foot of the staircase, a foot on the lowest step, his threadbare soutane gathered about him for the ascent with womanish care, nodding his head often and repeating, "Not a doubt of it, Mr. Hackett, very fine, not a doubt of it." In the middle of the hall, the prefect of the college sodality was speaking earnestly in a soft, querulous voice with a border. As he spoke, he wrinkled a little his freckled brow and bit between his phrases at a tiny bone a pencil. "I hope the matric men will all come. The first arts men are pretty sure. Second arts, too. We must make sure of the newcomers." Temple bent again across Cranley as they were passing through the doorway and said in a swift whisper, "Do you know that he is a married man? He was a married man before they converted him. He has a wife and children somewhere. By hell, I think that's the queerest notion I ever heard, huh?" His whisper trailed off into sly, crackling laughter. The moment they were through the doorway, Cranley seized him rudely by the neck and shook him, saying, "You flaming, floundering fool, I'll take my dying Bible. There isn't a bigger bloody ape, do you know, than you in the whole flaming bloody world." Temple wriggled in his grip, laughing still with sly content, while Cranley repeated flatly at every rude shake, "A flaming, flaring, bloody idiot!" They crossed the weedy garden together. The President, wrapped in a heavy loose cloak, was coming towards them along one of the walks, reading his office. At the end of the walk he halted before turning, and raised his eyes. The students saluted, Temple fumbling as before at the peak of his cap. They walked forward in silence. As they neared the alley, Stephen could hear the thuds of the players' hands and the wet smacks of the ball, and Davin's voice crying out excitedly at each stroke. The three students halted round the box on which Davin sat to follow the game. Temple, after a few moments, sidled across to Stephen and said, "Excuse me, I wanted to ask you, do you believe that Jean-Jacques Rousseau was a sincere man?" Stephen laughed outright. Cranley, picking up the broken stave of a cask from the grass at his foot, turned swiftly and said sternly, "Temple, I declare to the living God, if you say another word, do you know, to anybody on any subject, I'll kill you super spotum." "He was like you, I fancy," said Stephen, "an emotional man." "Blast him, curse him," said Cranley broadly. "Don't talk to him at all. She might as well be talking, do you know, to a flaming chamber pot as talking to Temple. Go home, Temple, for God's sake, go home." "I don't care a damn about you, Cranley," answered Temple, moving out of reach of the uplifted stave and pointing at Stephen. "He's the only man I see in this institution who has an individual mind." "Institution, individual," cried Cranley. "Go home, blast you, for you're a hopeless bloody man." "I'm an emotional man," said Temple. "That's quite rightly expressed, and I'm proud that I'm an emotionalist." He sidled out of the alley, smiling slyly. Cranley watched him with a blank, expressionless face. "Look at him," he said. "Did you ever see such a go by the wall?" His phrase was greeted by a strange laugh from a student who lounged against the wall, his peaked cap down on his eyes. The laugh, pitched in a high key and coming from so muscular frame, seemed like the whinny of an elephant. The student's body shook all over, and to ease the mirth he rubbed both his hands delightedly over his groins. "Lynch is awake," said Cranley. Lynch, for answer, straightened himself and thrust forward his chest. "Lynch puts out his chest," said Stephen, "as a criticism of life." Lynch smote himself sonorously on the chest and said, "Who has anything to say about my girth?" Cranley took him at the word, and the two began to tussle. When their faces had flushed with the struggle, they drew apart, panting. Stephen bent down towards Davin, who, intent on the game, had paid no heed to the talk of the others. "And how is my little tame goose?" he asked. "Did he sign too?" Davin nodded and said, "And you, Stevie?" Stephen shook his head. "You're a terrible man, Stevie," said Davin, taking a short pipe from his mouth. "Always alone." "Now that you have signed the petition for universal peace," said Stephen, "I suppose you will burn that little copybook I saw in your room." As Davin did not answer, Stephen began to quote, "Long pace, Fianna, right incline, Fianna, Fianna, by members, Fianna, salute 1-2. "That's a different question," said Devon. "I'm an Irish nationalist first and foremost, but that's you all out. You're a born sneerer, Stevie." "When you make the next rebellion with hurley sticks," said Stephen, "and want the indispensable informer, tell me. I can find you a few in this college."
"I can't understand you," said Devon.
"One time I hear you talk about English literature, against English literature. Now you talk against the Irish informers. What with your name and your ideas, are you Irish at all?"
"Come with me now to the office of arms, and I will show you the tree of my family," said Stephen.
"Then be one of us," said Devon. "Why don't you learn Irish? Why did you drop out of the league class after the first lesson?"
"You know one reason why," answered Stephen.
Devon tossed his head and laughed.
"Oh, come now," he said. "Is it on account of that certain young lady and Father Moran? But that's all in your own mind, Stevie. They were only talking and laughing."
Stephen paused and laid a friendly hand upon Devon's shoulder. "Do you remember," he said, "when we knew each other first? The first morning we met, you asked me to show you the way to the matriculation class, putting a very strong stress on the first syllable. Do you remember? Then you used to address the Jesuits as Father. Do you remember? I asked myself about you, is he as innocent as his speech?"
"I'm a simple person," said Devon. "You know that.
When you told me that night in Harcourt Street those things about your private life, honest to God, Stevie, I was not able to eat my dinner. It was quite bad. I was awake a long time that night. Why did you tell me those things?"
"Thanks," said Stephen. "You mean I am a monster?"
"No," said Devon, "but I wish you had not told me."
A tide began to surge beneath the calm surface of Stephen's friendliness. "This race and this country and this life produced me," he said. "I shall express myself as I am."
"Try to be one of us," repeated Devon. "In your heart you are an Irishman, but your pride is too powerful."
"My ancestors threw off their language and took another," Stephen said. "They allowed a handful of foreigners to subject them. Do you fancy I am going to pay in my own life and person debts they made? What for?"
"For our freedom," said Devon.
"No honourable and sincere man," said Stephen, "has given up to you his life and his youth and his affections from the days of Tone to those of Parnell, but you sold him to the enemy, or failed him in need, or reviled him and left him for another, and you invite me to be one of you. I'd see you damned first."
"They died for their ideals, Stephen," said Devon. "Our day will come, believe me."
Stephen, following his own thought, was silent for an instant.
"The soul is born," he said vaguely, "first in those moments I told you of. It has a slow and dark birth, more mysterious than the birth of the body. When the soul of a man is born in this country, there are nets flung at it to hold it back from flight. You talk to me of nationality, language, religion. I shall try to fly by those nets."
Devon knocked the ashes from his pipe.
"Too deep for me, Stevie," he said. "But a man's country comes first. Ireland first, Stevie. You can be a poet or mystic after."
"Do you know what Ireland is?" asked Stephen with cold violence.
"Ireland is the old sow that eats her farrow."
Devon rose from his box and went towards the players, shaking his head softly. But in a moment his sadness left him, and he was hotly disputing with Cranley and the two players who had finished their game. A match of four was arranged, Cranley insisting, however, that his ball should be used. He let it rebound twice or thrice to his hand, and struck it strongly and swiftly towards the base of the alley, exclaiming in answer to its thud,
"Your soul!"
Stephen stood with Lynch till the score began to rise. Then he plucked him by the sleeve to come away. Lynch obeyed, saying,
"Let us eke go, as Cranley has it."
Stephen smiled at the side thrust. They passed back through the garden and out through the hall, where the stuttering porter was pinning up a notice in the frame. At the foot of the steps they halted, and Stephen took a packet of cigarettes from his pocket and offered it to his companion.
"I know you are poor," he said.
"Damn your yellow insolence," answered Lynch. This second proof of Lynch's culture made Stephen smile again.
"It was a great day for European culture," he said, "when you made up your mind to swear in yellow."
They lit their cigarettes and turned to the right. After a pause, Stephen began,
"Aristotle has not defined pity and terror. I have. I say..."
Lynch halted and said bluntly,
"Stop. I won't listen. I am sick. I was out last night on a yellow drunk with Horan and Goggins."
Stephen went on,
"Pity is the feeling which arrests the mind in the presence of what whatsoever is grave and constant in human sufferings, and unites it with the human sufferer. Terror is the feeling which arrests the mind in the presence of whatsoever is grave and constant in human sufferings, and unites it with the secret cause.
Repeat, said Lynch.
Stephen repeated the definitions slowly.
A girl got into a hansom a few days ago, he went on, in London. She was on her way to meet her mother, whom she had not seen for many years. At the corner of a street, the shaft of a lorry shivered the window of the hansom in the shape of a star. A long, fine needle of slivered glass pierced at her heart. She died on the instant. The reporter called it a tragic death. It is not. It is remote from terror and pity, according to the terms of my definitions.
The tragic emotion, in fact, is a face looking two ways, towards terror and towards pity, both of which are phases in it. You see, I used the word arrest. I mean that the tragic emotion is static, or rather the dramatic emotion is. The feelings excited by improper art are kinetic, desire or loathing. Desire urges us to possess, to go from something, to go to something. Loathing urges us to abandon, to go from something. These are kinetic emotions. The arts which excite them, pornographical or didactic, are therefore improper arts. The aesthetic emotion, I used a general term, is therefore static. The mind is arrested and raised above desire and loathing.
You say that art must not excite desire, said Lynch. I told you that one day I wrote my name in pencil on the backside of the Venus of Praxiteles in a museum. Was that not desire?
I speak of normal desires, said Stephen.
You also told me that when you were a boy in that charming Carmelite school you ate pieces of dried cow dung.
Lynch broke again into a whinny of laughter and again rubbed both his hands over his groins, but without taking them from his pockets.
Oh, I did, he cried.
Stephen turned towards his companion and looked at him for a moment boldly in the eyes. Lynch, recovering from his laughter, answered his look from his humbled eyes. The long, slender, flattened skull beneath the long, pointed cap brought before Stephen's mind the image of a hooded reptile. The eyes, too, were reptile-like in glint and gaze, yet at that instant, humbled and alert in their look, they were lit by one tiny human point, the window of a shriveled soul, poignant and self-embittered.
As for that, Stephen said in polite parentheses, we are all animals. I also am an animal.
You are, said Lynch.
But we are just now in a mental world, Stephen continued. The desire and loathing excited by improper aesthetic means are really unaesthetic emotions, not only because they are kinetic in character, but also because they are not more than physical. Our flesh shrinks from what it dreads and responds to the stimulus of what it desires by a purely reflex action of the nervous system. Our eyelid closes before we are aware that the fly is about to enter our eye.
Not always, said Lynch critically.
In the same way, said Stephen, your flesh responded to the stimulus of a naked statue, but it was, I say, simply a reflex action of the nerves. Beauty expressed by the artist cannot awaken in us an emotion which is kinetic or a sensation which is purely physical. It awakens, or ought to awaken, or induces, or ought to induce, an aesthetic stasis, an ideal pity or an ideal terror, a stasis caught forth, prolonged and at last dissolved by what I call the rhythm of beauty.
What is that exactly? Asked Lynch.
Rhythm, said Stephen, is the first formal aesthetic relation of part to part in any aesthetic whole, or of an aesthetic whole to its part or parts of, or of any part to the aesthetic whole of which it is a part.
If that is rhythm, said Lynch, let me hear what you call beauty. And please remember, though I did eat a cake of cow dung once, that I admire only beauty.
Stephen raised his cap as if in greeting. Then, blushing slightly, he laid his hand on Lynch's thick tweed sleeve.
We are right, he said, and the others are wrong. To speak of these things and to try to understand their nature, and, having understood it, to try slowly and humbly and constantly to express, to press out again from the gross earth, or what it brings forth from sound and shape and colour, which are the prison gates of our soul, an image of the beauty we have come to understand, that is art.
They had reached the canal bridge and
turning from their course, went on by the trees. A crude grey light mirrored in the sluggish water, and the smell of wet branches over their heads seemed to war against the course of Stephen's thought. "But you have not answered my question," said Lynch. "What is art? What is the beauty it expresses?" "That was the first definition I gave you, you sleepy-headed wretch," said Stephen, "when I began to try to think out the matter for myself. Do you remember the night Cranley lost his temper and began to talk about Wicklow bacon?"
"I remember," said Lynch.
"He told us about them flaming fat devils of pigs." "Art," said Stephen, "is the human disposition of sensible or intelligible matter for an aesthetic end. You remember the pigs and forget that. You are a distressing pair, you and Cranley."
Lynch made a grimace at the raw grey sky and said, "If I am to listen to your aesthetic philosophy, give me at least another cigarette. I don't care about it. I don't even care about women. Damn you and damn everything. I want a job of 500 a year. You can't get me one."
Stephen handed him the packet of cigarettes. Lynch took the last one that remained, saying simply,
"Proceed."
"Aquinas," said Stephen, "says that is beautiful the apprehension of which pleases." Lynch nodded. "I remember that," he said. "Pulchra sunt quo visa placent." "He uses the word visa," said Stephen, "to cover aesthetic apprehensions of all kinds, whether through sight or of hearing or through any other avenue or of apprehension. This word, though it is vague, is clear enough to keep away good and evil which excite desire and loathing. It means, certainly, a stasis and not a kinesis." "How about the true?" "It produces also a stasis of the mind. You would not write your name in pencil across the hypotenuse of a right-angled triangle."
"No," said Lynch. "Give me the hypotenuse of the Venus of Praxiteles."
"Praxiteles, Praxiteles."
"Static, therefore," said Stephen. "Plato, I believe, said that beauty is the splendour of truth. I don't think that it has a meaning, but the true and the beautiful are akin. Truth is beheld by the intellect, which is appeased by the most satisfying relations of the intelligible. Beauty is beheld by the imagination, which is appeased by the most satisfying relations of the sensible. The first step in the direction of truth is to understand the frame and scope of the intellect itself, to comprehend the act itself of intellection. Aristotle's entire system of philosophy rests upon this book of psychology, and that, I think, rests on his statement that the same attribute cannot at the same time and in the same connection belong to and not belong to the same object. The first step in the direction of beauty is to understand the frame and scope of the imagination, to comprehend the act itself of aesthetic apprehension. Is that clear?"
"But what is beauty?" asked Lynch impatiently. "Out with another definition. Something we see and like. Is that the best you and Aquinas can do?"
"Let us take woman," said Stephen.
"Let us take her," said Lynch fervently. "The Greek, the Turk, the Chinese, the Copt, the Hottentot," said Stephen, "all admire a different type of female beauty. That seems to be a maze out of which we cannot escape. I see, however, two ways out. One is this hypothesis, that every physical quality admired by men in women is in direct connection with the manifold functions of women for the propagation of the species. It may be so. The world, it seems, is drearier than even you, Lynch, imagined. For my part, I dislike that way out. It leads to eugenics rather than to aesthetic. It leads you out of the maze into a new gaudy lecture room where McCann, with one hand on the origin of species and the other hand on the New Testament, tells you that you admired the great flanks of Venus because you felt that she would bear you burly offspring, and admired her great breasts because you felt that she would give good milk to her children and yours."
"Then McCann is a sulphur-yellow liar," said Lynch energetically.
"There remains another way out," said Stephen, laughing.
"To wit," said Lynch.
"This hypothesis," Stephen began. A long dray laden with old iron came round the corner of Sir Patrick Dunn's hospital, covering the end of Stephen's speech with the harsh roar of jangled and rattling metal. Lynch closed his ears and gave out an oath after oath till the dray had passed. Then he turned on his heel rudely. Stephen turned also, and waited for a few moments till his companion's ill-humour had had its vent. This hypothesis, Stephen repeated, is the other way out, that though the same object may not seem beautiful to all people who admire a beautiful object find in it certain relations which satisfy and coincide with the stages themselves of all aesthetic apprehension. These relations of the sensible, visible to you through one form and to me through another, must be therefore the necessary qualities of beauty. Now we can return to our old friend St. Thomas for another pennyworth of wisdom. Lynch laughed. It amuses me vastly, he said, to hear you quoting him time after time like a jolly round friar. Are you laughing in your sleeve? McAllister, answered Stephen, would call my aesthetic theory applied Aquinas. As far as this side of aesthetic philosophy extends, Aquinas will carry me all along the line. When we come to the phenomena of artistic conception, artistic gestation, and artistic reproduction, I require a new terminology and a new personal experience. Of course, said Lynch. After all, Aquinas, in spite of his intellect, was exactly a good round friar, but you will tell me about the new personal experience and new terminology some other day. Hurry up and finish the first part. Who knows, said Stephen, smiling. Perhaps Aquinas would understand me better than you. He was a poet himself. He wrote a hymn for Maundy Thursday. It begins with the words, Pange lingua glorosi. They say it is the highest glory of the hymnal. It is an intricate and soothing hymn. I like it, but there is no hymn that can be put beside that mournful and majestic processional song, the Vexilla Regis of Venantius Fortunatus. Lynch began to sing softly and solemnly in a deep bass voice. Implita sunt quoe consinit David fideli carmine dicendo nasciambus regnavit a lingo deus. That's great, he said, well pleased. Great music. They turned into Lower Mount Street. A few steps from the corner, a fat young man wearing a silk neckcloth saluted them and stopped. Did you hear the results of the exams? He asked. Griffin was plucked. Halpin and O'Flynn are through the home civil. Moonan got fifth place in the Indian. O'Shaughnessy got 14th. The Irish fellows in Clark's gave them a feed last night. They all ate curry. His pallid, bloated face expressed benevolent malice, and as he had advanced through his tidings of success, his small, fat-encircled eyes vanished out of sight and his weak, wheezing voice out of hearing. In reply to a question of Stephen's, his eyes and his voice came forth again from their lurking places. "Yes, McCullough and I," he said. "He's taken pure mathematics and I'm taking constitutional history. There are 20 subjects. I'm taking botany, too. You know I'm a member of the field club." He drew back from the other two in a stately fashion and placed a plump, woolen-gloved hand on his breast, from which muttered wheezing laughter at once broke forth. "Bring us a few turnips and onions the next time you go out," said Stephen dryly, "to make a stew." The fat student laughed indulgently and said, "We are all highly respectable people in the field club. Last Saturday we went to Glenmalure, 7 of us." "With women, Donovan," said Lynch. Donovan again laid his hand on his chest and said, "Our end is the acquisition of knowledge." Then he said quickly, "I hear you are writing some essay about aesthetics." Stephen made a vague gesture of denial. "Goethe and Lessing," said Donovan, "have written a lot on that subject. The classical school and the romantic school and all that. The Laocoon interested me very much when I read it. Of course it's idealistic, German, ultra-profound." Neither of the others spoke. Donovan took leave of them urbanely. "I must go," he said softly and benevolently. "I have a strong suspicion, amounting almost to a conviction, that my sister intended to make pancakes today for the dinner of the Donovan family." "Goodbye," Stephen said in his wake. "Don't forget the turnips for me and my mate." Lynch gazed after him, his lip curling in slow scorn till his face resembled a devil's mask. "To think that that yellow pancake-eating excrement can get a good job," he said at length, "and I have to smoke cheap cigarettes." They turned their faces towards Merrion Square and went on for a little in silence. "To finish what I was saying about beauty," said Stephen, "the most satisfying relations of the sensible must therefore correspond to the necessary phases of artistic apprehension. Find these, and you find the qualities of universal beauty. Aquinas says, ad pulchritudinem tria requiruntur integritas consonantia claritas, I translated. So, three things are needed for beauty, wholeness and harmony and radiance. Do these correspond to the phases of apprehension? Are you following?
Of course I am, said Lynch. If you think I have an excrementitious intelligence, run after Donovan and ask him to listen to you.
Stephen pointed to a basket which a butcher boy had slung inverted on his head.
Look at that basket, he said.
I see it, said Lynch.
In order to see that basket, said Stephen, your mind, first of all, separates the basket from the rest of the visible universe, which is not the basket. The first phase of apprehension is a bounding line drawn about the object to be apprehended. An aesthetic image is presented to us either in space or in time. What is audible is presented in time. What is visible is presented in space. But temporal or spatial, the aesthetic image is first luminously apprehended as self-bounded and self-contained upon the immeasurable background of space or time, which is not it. You apprehend it as one thing. You see it as one whole. You apprehend its wholeness. That is integritas.
Bullseye, said Lynch, laughing. Go on.
Then, said Stephen, you pass from point to point, led by its formal lines. You apprehend it as balanced part against part within its limits. You feel the rhythm of its structure. In other words, the synthesis of immediate perception is followed by the analysis of apprehension. Having first felt that it is one thing, you feel now that it is a thing. You apprehended it as complex, multiple, divisible, separable, made up of its parts, the result of its parts and their sum, harmonious. That is consonantia.
Bullseye again, said Lynch wittily. Tell me now what is claritas and you win the cigar.
The connotation of the word, Stephen said, is rather vague. Aquinas uses a term which seems to be inexact. It baffled me for a long time. It would lead you to believe that he had in mind symbolism or idealism, the supreme quality of beauty being a light from some other world, the idea of which the matter is but the shadow, the reality of which is but the symbol. I thought he might mean that claritas is the artistic discovery and representation of the divine purpose in anything, or a force of generalization which would make the aesthetic image a universal one, make it outshine its proper conditions. But that is literary talk. I understand it so. When you have apprehended that basket as one thing, and have then analyzed it according to its form, and apprehended it as a thing, you make the only synthesis which is logically and aesthetically permissible. You see that it is that thing which it is, and no other thing. The radiance of which he speaks is the scholastic quidatis, quiditas, the whatness of a thing. This supreme quality is felt by the artist when the aesthetic image is first conceived in his imagination. The mind, in that mysterious instant, Shelley likened beautifully to a fading coal. The instant wherein that supreme quality of beauty, the clear radiance of the aesthetic image, is apprehended luminously by the mind, which has been arrested by its wholeness and fascinated by its harmony, is the luminous, silent stasis of aesthetic pleasure, a spiritual state very like that cardiac condition which the Italian psychologist Luigi Galvani, using a phrase almost as beautiful as Shelley's, called the enchantment of the heart.
Stephen paused, and, though his companion did not speak, felt that his words had called up around them a thought-enchanted silence.
What I have said, he began again, refers to beauty in the wider sense of the world, in the sense which the world has in the literary tradition. In the marketplace it has another sense. When we speak of beauty in the second sense of the term, our judgment is influenced in the first place by the art itself and by the form of that art. The image, it is clear, must be set between the mind or the senses of the artist himself, and the mind or the senses of others. If you bear this in memory, you will see that art necessarily divides itself into three forms, progressing from one to the next. These forms are the lyrical form, the form wherein the artist presents his image in immediate relation to himself, the epical form, the form wherein he presents his image in immediate relation to himself and to others, the dramatic form, the form wherein he presents his image in immediate relation to others.
That you told me a few nights ago, said Lynch, and we began the famous discussion.
I have a book at home, said Stephen, in which I have written down questions which are more amusing than yours were. In finding the answers to them, I found the theory of aesthetic which I am trying to explain.
There are some questions I set myself. Is a chair finely made, tragic or comic? Is the portrait of Mona Lisa good if I desire to see it? Is the bust of Sir Philip Crampton lyrical, epical or dramatic? Can excrement or a child or a louse be a work of art? If not, why not? Why not indeed? Said Lynch, laughing. If a man, hacking in fury at a block of wood, Stephen continued, made there an image of a cow, is that image a work of art? If not, why not? That's a lovely one, said Lynch, laughing again. That has the true scholastic stink. Lessing, Stephen, said Stephen, should not have taken a group of statues to write of. The art, being inferior, does not present the forms I spoke of distinguished clearly one from another. Even in literature, the highest and most spiritual art, the forms are often confused. The lyrical form is, in fact, the simplest verbal vesture of an instant of emotion. A rhythmical cry such as ages ago cheered on the man who pulled at the oar or dragged stone up a slope. He who utters it is more conscious of the instant of emotion than of himself as feeling emotion. The simplest epical form is seen emerging out of lyrical literature when the artist prolongs and broods upon himself as the centre of an epical event, and this form progresses till the centre of emotional gravity is equidistant from the artist himself and from others. The narrative is no longer purely personal. The personality of the artist passes into the narration itself, flowing round and round the persons and the actions like a vital sea. This progress you will see easily in that old English ballad, Turpin Hero, which begins in the first person and ends in the third person. The dramatic form is reached when the vitality which has flowed and eddied round each person fills every person with such vital force that he or she assumes a power and intelligible aesthetic life. The personality of the artist, at first a cry or a cadence or a mood, and then a fluid and lambent narrative, finally refines itself out of existence, impersonalizes itself, so to speak. The aesthetic image in the dramatic form is life purified in and reprojected from the human imagination. The mystery of aesthetic, like that of material creation, is accomplished. The artist, like the god of the creation, remains within or behind or beyond or above his handiwork, invisible, refined out of existence, indifferent, paring his fingernails. Trying to refine them also out of existence, said Lynch. A fine rain began to fall from the high, veiled sky, and they turned into the Duke's lawn to reach the National Library before the shower came. What do you mean, Lynch asked surlily, by prating about beauty and the imagination in this miserable, godforsaken island? No wonder the artist retired within or behind his handiwork after having perpetrated this country. The rain fell faster. When they passed through the passage beside the Royal Irish Academy, they found many students sheltering under the arcade of the library. Cranley, leaning against a pillar, was picking his teeth with a sharpened match, listening to some companions. Some girls stood near the entrance door. Lynch whispered to Stephen, "Your beloved is here." Stephen took his place silently on the step below the group of students, heedless of the rain which fell fast, turning his eyes towards her from time to time. She too stood silently among her companions. She has no priest to flirt with, he thought with conscious bitterness, remembering how he had seen her last. Lynch was right. His mind, emptied of theory and courage, lapsed back into a listless peace. He heard the students talking among themselves. They spoke of two friends who had passed the final medical examination, of the chances of getting places and ocean liners, of poor and rich practices. "That's all a bubble. An Irish country practices better. Hines was 2 years in Liverpool, and he says the same. A frightful hole, he said it was. Nothing but midwifery cases. Half a crown cases. Do you mean to say it is better to have a job here in the country than in a rich city like that? I know a fellow. Hines has no brains. He got through by stewing. Pure stewing. Don't mind him. There's plenty of money to be made in a big commercial city. Depends on the practice. Ego credo in vita pauperum est simpliter atrox, simpliciter sanguinius atrox in Liverpoolio. Their voices reached his ears as if from a distance, in interrupted pulsation. She was preparing to go away with her companions. The quick light shower had drawn off, tarrying in clusters of diamonds among the shrubs of the quadrangle where an exhalation was breathed forth by the blackened earth. Their trim boots prattled as they stood on the steps of the colonnade, talking quietly and gaily, glancing at the clouds, holding their umbrellas at cunning angles against the last few raindrops, closing them again, holding their skirts demurely. And if he had judged her harshly? If her life were a simple rosary of hours, her life simple and strange as a bird's life, gay in the morning, restless all day, tired at sundown, her heart simple and wilful as a bird's heart. And we have a good place to stop. In fact, I think it's the only break in this entire chapter. So next time we shall resume chapter